Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon. My name is Rowan Conway. For those of you who don't know me, I am the Director of Innovation and Development here at the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you here today for the RSA Thursday event. Before we begin, can I ask you to turn your mobiles to silent? We are live streaming today over the web, so a big hello to those who are watching online. Or we're audio streaming. I'm seeing a no, no, we're not. But we're audio streaming live on the web. So please do join us online with the hashtag RSA Sleep. But before, without further ado, let me get to our speaker. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest speaker, Professor Matthew Walker. Matthew Walker is Professor of Neuroscience and Psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and Director of the Center for Human Sleep Science. He is conducting his own experiment this week as he is riddled with jet lag, and then he has to go back to California by the time he's just about recalibrated. His research has led him to the conclusion that we are all suffering from catastrophic sleep deprivation epidemic, one of the greatest public health crises of our time. Sleep loss costs the UK economy over £30 billion per year in lost revenue, or 2% of GDP. So what could we do about it? We're delighted to hear about all of the things that are in this extremely interesting book, Why We Sleep. So I won't keep you any further. Please join me in welcoming Matthew Walker.
Thank you. So it's a delight and a pleasure to be speaking with you, and I will perhaps just await the slide if it comes up. I see movement on my screen, and aha, success. So thank you. It is wonderful to be speaking with you, and I would actually like to start with testicles. Men who sleep 6 hours or less have significantly smaller testicles than those who sleep 8 hours or more. In addition, men who sleep just 5 to 6 hours a night will have a level of testosterone which is that of someone 10 years their senior. A lack of sleep ages you by a decade in terms of that critical aspect of wellness and virility. And we actually see equivalent impairments in female reproductive health caused by insufficient sleep. This is the best news that I have for you during this presentation. From this point forward, it's only going to get worse. Rather than tell you about the wonderfully good things that happen when you get sleep, I'm going to tell you about the alarmingly bad things that happen when you don't get enough, both for your brain and for your body. Let me start with the brain and specifically tell you about the functions of learning and memory. What we've discovered over, I think, the past 10 or 15 years is that you need sleep after learning to essentially hit the save button on those new memories so that you don't forget. So sleep essentially future-proofs those facts within the brain. But recently we've discovered that it's not just about sleeping after learning, you also need to sleep before learning. And now to actually prepare your brain, sort of almost like a dry sponge, as it were, to initially soak up new information. And without sleep, those memory circuits within the brain effectively become waterlogged and you can't absorb information. So let me show you the evidence. Here in this study, we actually decided to test the hypothesis that pulling the all-nighter was a good idea. How do you do that? Well, we took a group of healthy adults and we assigned them to one of two experimental conditions, a sleep group and a sleep deprivation group. Now, the sleep group, we're going to give them a full 8 hours of shut-eye across the night. The deprivation group, we're going to keep awake all night in the laboratory under full supervision. There's no naps, by the way, no caffeine. It is miserable for us and for them, miserable for everyone. And then we're going to actually place them inside an MRI scanner the next day and have them try and learn a whole list of new facts as we're taking snapshots of brain activity. And then we're going to test them to see how effective that learning has been. And that's actually what you're looking at here on the vertical axis, the amount of learning. So the higher up you are, the more that you learn. And when you put those two groups head to head, what you find is a quite significant 40% deficit in the ability of the brain to make new memories without sleep. And I think that should be concerning, especially considering what we know is happening to sleep in our education populations right now. Just to sort of frame that in context, it would be the difference between acing an exam and failing it miserably. And we've gone on to discover what actually goes wrong within the brain to produce these types of learning disabilities. And there's a structure on the left and the right side of your brain called the hippocampus. And you can see it here in these orange-yellow colors. Think of the hippocampus like the informational inbox of your brain. It's very good at receiving new memory files and holding on to them. And when we looked at this structure in those people who'd had a full night of sleep, what we saw was lots of healthy learning-related activity. Yet in those people who were sleep-deprived, we actually couldn't find any significant signal whatsoever. It's almost as though sleep deprivation had shut down your memory inbox. And any new incoming files, they were just being bounced. You couldn't effectively commit new experiences to memory. And I should note, by the way, if you would like to understand what life is like without a functioning hippocampus, just watch the movie Memento. I suspect some of you have seen it. Great film. And for those who haven't, I won't spoil a punchline. But this gentleman suffers brain damage. And from that point forward, he can no longer make any new memories. He's what we call densely amnesic. The part of his brain that was damaged was the hippocampus. And it is the very same structure that sleep deprivation will attack and block your brain's capacity for new learning. So that's the bad that happens when you take sleep away. But let me actually just come back to that control group for a second. Do you remember those people who got a full 8 hours of sleep? We can ask a very different question here. What is it about the physiological quality of sleep when you do get it, that actually restores and boosts your learning and memory ability each and every day? And what we've discovered by placing electrodes all over the head is that there are big, powerful brain waves that happen during the very deepest stages of sleep that have riding on top of them these spectacular bursts of electrical activity called sleep spindles. And it's the combined quality of these deep sleep brainwaves that actually acts like a file transfer mechanism at night. It actually takes memories from a short-term vulnerable reservoir and shifts them across to a more permanent long-term storage site in the brain. Almost like moving files from a USB stick to a hippocampus. So that you protect those memories, you remember rather than forget, and you wake up with a refreshed learning ability all over again. It's this sort of elegant, symbiotic system of memory that happens every night when you place your head on the pillow. It's just magical. And it's important that we understand what it is during sleep, mechanistically, that is actually transacting these memory benefits. Because there are real clinical and medical implications. Let me tell you about one area that we've now moved this work out into medically, which is the context of aging and dementia. Because I think we all know that as we progress in life, our learning and memory abilities start to deteriorate, start to decline. But what we also know is that a physiological signature of aging is that your sleep gets worse. And not just any type of sleep, by the way, especially that deep quality of sleep that I was just describing. And only last year we published evidence that these two factors are not simply just co-occurring, they are significantly interrelated. And it suggests that the disruption of deep sleep is an underappreciated factor that is contributing to what we call cognitive decline or memory decline in aging. And most recently, we've discovered in Alzheimer's disease as well. Now, I know this is remarkably depressing news. I understand. But there is a possible silver lining here. Because unlike many of the other factors that we know are associated with aging and dementia, for example, changes in the physical structure of the brain or the vasculature of the brain, those are fiendishly difficult to treat right now, and we have no good approaches. But that sleep is a missing piece in the explanatory puzzle of aging and Alzheimer's is exciting because we may be able to do something about it. And one way that we are approaching this in my sleep center is not by using sleeping pills, by the way, I should note. Unfortunately and sadly, they do not produce naturalistic sleep, and they've also been associated with a higher risk of death and cancer. And I'm happy to speak about that evidence during Q&A. Instead, we are actually developing a method based on this technique. It is called direct current brain stimulation. You apply electrode pads to the head, and you insert a small amount of voltage into the brain. And so small, you tend not to feel it, but it actually has a measurable impact on those brain waves. Now, if you apply this stimulation during sleep in young, healthy adults, as if you're sort of singing in time with those deep sleep brain waves, not only can you actually amplify the size of those deep sleep brain waves, but in doing so, you almost double the amount of memory benefit that you get from sleep. The question now is whether we can translate this same affordable, potentially portable piece of technology into older adults and those with dementia. Can we restore back some healthy quality of deep sleep? And in doing so, can we salvage aspects of learning and memory function? That is my real hope now. That's one of our sort of moonshot goals, as it were. So that's sleep for learning, memory, aging, Alzheimer's. What else is sleep good for? Let me tell you that sleep is essential to help stabilize your emotional and mental health. And without sleep, the emotional circuits and networks within the brain become hyperactive and irrational. Allow me to demonstrate with a sleep-deprived subject. Because it turns out that we do video diaries with our participants throughout these deprivation nights. And you're going to meet one under the pseudonym of Jeff. Jeff has just entered the study. It is 11:30 at night on day one. He's been awake for a perfectly normal 16 hours. And let's hear from Jeff what his hopes and aspirations are for the deprivation period. And I hope that you can hear this. Is the sound on?
Hello. It's about 11:27 right now. I've been here for about about an hour. So it's the first hour. I'm writing my paper right now, a 30-page paper. Hopefully I can get some of it done before I get too sleepy.
Jeff, a perfectly likable, affable fellow who is hoping to get his 30-page report complete in a night of sleep deprivation. Classic delusional undergraduate thinking, I have to say. I see it all the time in my students. So now let's actually fast forward the clock. It's now 5:30 the following morning. Jeff has now been awake for 22 hours straight. And instantly you'll sort of notice one of the hallmark features of sleep deprivation, which is that you slide down in your chair. Jeff is down about, you can just look around the theater right now. Jeff is down about 6 inches here now. It's about an inch for every hour that you've been awake beyond a standard 16 based on our incredibly complex, sophisticated algorithms. But in all truth, just notice how emotionally different Jeff has become. And I think some have rather perhaps unkindly described him as becoming a little bit emotionally unhinged. So let's hear from Jeff how that 30-page report has been going. And I apologize, by the way, ahead of time for the profanity.
Hello. I'm very angry right now. Because I didn't get any fucking... Can I curse on this? I think, whatever. They probably think I'm crazy. I'm very lucid, actually.
So, did you notice how Jeff went from being remarkably upset and annoyed that he'd got none of his 30-page report complete to then finding it almost hilarious? He was nearly sort of punch-drunk, giddy on sleep deprivation, and then came right back down to baseline again. That is a remarkably abnormal emotional distance to travel within such a short time period. And I think it emphasizes the type of destabilizing influence that a lack of sleep has on our emotional integrity. And we've since uncovered what changes within your brain to produce this type of pendulum emotional irrationality. Now, there is a structure that sits very deep within your brain called the amygdala, and you can see it here in these red colors. Again, you have one on the left side and one on the right. And the amygdala is one of the centerpiece regions for the generation of emotional reactions, particularly strong negative emotional reactions. And when we looked at this structure in those people who had had a full night of sleep, what we saw was a nice, controlled, modest degree of reactivity. Yet in those people who were sleep deprived, we found this amplified, almost aggravated degree of responsivity. The amygdala was actually 60% more reactive under conditions of sleep loss. And it's almost as though without sleep, we become all sort of emotional accelerator pedal and too little regulatory control brake, as it were. But what I find perhaps more concerning is that this represents a neurological signature that is not dissimilar to numerous psychiatric conditions. And we are now finding significant links between sleep disruption and conditions such as depression, anxiety, including PTSD, schizophrenia, and tragically, suicide as well. In fact, we cannot find a single psychiatric condition in which sleep is normal. I think sleep has a profound story to tell in both our understanding, our treatment, and maybe even ultimately our prevention of grave mental illness. I really think it's there. So that's sleep for the brain. Sleep is just as essential for your body, though. And here I could have selected any one of the model systems and gone into detail. We've already spoken about sleep and the reproductive system. I could tell you about sleep and the metabolic system, that after 1 week of short sleep, your blood sugar levels are disrupted so strikingly that your GP would subsequently classify you as being pre-diabetic. I could tell you about sleep in the cardiovascular system, that all it takes is 1 hour. Because there is a global experiment that is performed on about 1.5 billion people across 70 countries twice a year called daylight savings time. Now, in the spring, when we lose an hour of sleep, there is a 24% increase in heart attacks. In the autumn, when we gain an hour of sleep opportunity, there is a 21% decrease in heart attacks. That is how fragile and vulnerable your cardiovascular system is to even just the smallest perturbation of sleep. I think many of us think nothing of shortchanging ourselves of an hour of sleep. But in terms of a deeper dive, I actually want to focus here on sleep and the immune system. And I will introduce these delightful blue elements in the image. They are called natural killer cells. Think of natural killer cells like the Secret Service agents of your immune system. They are very good at identifying dangerous foreign elements and eliminating them. In fact, what they're doing here is embedding themselves into a malignant, a cancerous tumor mass and destroying it. So what you want is a virile set of these cancer-fighting immune assassins at all times. And tragically, that's what you don't have if you're not sleeping enough. So here in this study, from my wonderful colleague, Mike Irwin, you're not going to have your sleep deprived for an entire night. You're simply going to have your sleep restricted to 4 hours for one single night. And then we're going to look to see what is the percent reduction in immune cell activity that you suffer. And it's not small. It's not 10%. It's not 30%. What you actually see is a 70% reduction in natural killer cell activity. That's quite a concerning state of immune deficiency. And it happens quickly after just one night. Imagine the state of your immune system perhaps after weeks, if not years, of insufficient sleep. And it should therefore come as no surprise to learn that we have significant links between short sleep duration and numerous forms of cancer. Currently, that list includes cancer of the bowel, cancer of the prostate, and cancer of the breast. And in fact, the link between a lack of sleep and cancer has become so strong that recently the World Health Organization decided to classify any form of nighttime shift work as a probable carcinogen. Jobs that may induce cancer because of a disruption of your sleep-wake rhythm. So you may have heard that old maxim. People would say, oh, you know, you can sleep when you're dead. Well, I'm being utterly serious. It is mortally unwise advice. Because if you adopt that mindset, we know that you will be both dead sooner and the quality of that now shorter life will be significantly worse. Short sleep predicts a shorter life. It predicts all-cause mortality. And I'm sorry to say, but the bad news keeps coming. Because if you are fighting a battle against cancer and not getting sufficient sleep, that cancer may grow more quickly and aggressively. So here I actually want to focus on the work not from my own sleep center, but a scientist called David Gozal at the University of Chicago. Now he explores the relationship between sleep loss and cancer in mice. So I know this isn't necessarily for everyone. And here is one of the studies that David did. He took a group of mice and he inoculated them with some cancer cells on the back. And then he gave that cancer a 1 month period to grow. And at the end of the month, he resected the skin and he measured the size of the tumor mass. Half of the mice were allowed to sleep normally during that 1 month period. The other half had their sleep restricted, not total deprivation, just sort of top and tailed in terms of their sleep, just sort of keeping them awake a little bit longer during the day and the night. So I'm going to play a video, very short, where David is pointing out the results, and now would be the time to look away if you prefer to. And you're going to see David pointing to a monitor with a mouse with the skin resected, and here it is, and you can see that tumor mass. This is in one of the mice that was allowed to sleep normally during that 1 month. I'll play the video, he'll drag the window down and reveal behind it another mouse. That mouse was in the sleep restriction group. And you will see the difference. This is the difference. There was a 200% increase in the size and speed of that cancerous growth associated with insufficient sleep. Worse still, the cancer in those underslept mice had actually metastasized. And that's just a medical description, meaning that the cancer had breached the original origin and invaded other areas, bone, other organ, as well as brain. When cancer becomes metastatic, that's when we see mortality rates escalate dramatically. So if you are fighting a battle against cancer and not getting sufficient sleep, it may not be dissimilar to putting petrol on an already aggressive fire. Sleep loss is an accelerant. And we now understand that it produces a harmful biological fertilizer for the more rampant and rapid growth of cancer. So where does this leave us? What is the piece of mental furniture I want to offer you as we sort of finish the talk? Well, I think it would be this. Sleep is not an optional lifestyle luxury. Sleep is a non-negotiable biological necessity. It's a life support system. And it is Mother Nature's best effort yet at contra-death. And the decimation of sleep throughout industrialized nations is having a demonstrable impact on our health and our wellness. It's been termed a silent sleep loss epidemic. And I think it is fast becoming one of the greatest public health challenges that we now face in the 21st century. I believe it is now time for us to reclaim our right to a full night of sleep. And to do so, by the way, without embarrassment or that terrible stigma of laziness. And in doing so, we may finally remember what it feels like to be awake during the day. And with that, I will simply say good night, good luck, and above all, I do hope you sleep well. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Now then, Matthew. So, as I settled down to bed with this tome, I was getting very excited. I was thinking, oh, this is going to give me lots of tools and tips on how to sleep well. I think within about maybe 15 minutes, I'd aged by a decade.
You're welcome.
On page one, we had heart attacks, car crashes, increased impacts on mental health, pre-diabetes, cancer and Alzheimer's. So the wake-up call that your book about sleep is very loud and clear. I think that you describe it as this lack of sleep as a slow form of self-euthanasia in the book. Yeah. So, you know, we do want our audience to go home and actually sleep well tonight. So in order to do that, can I try and pick out some of the other parts of the book that you maybe didn't allude to so much in the talk, where if we're talking about reclaiming our right and the benefits of sleep, you know, what is the good stuff? I love the way you describe this. You describe dreaming as a neurochemical bath for your mind in the book. And so can we feature a little bit on what are the good things about sleep so as to not have an anxiety-inducing everyone thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm not sleeping. I'm going to have cancer by tomorrow.
Yeah, I definitely can. And it reminds me, one of the earliest titles for the talk, which I never went with, thankfully, was Consciousness is Overrated. I was thinking that would be a great start for people. But in terms of the benefits, there really is not one single tissue or organ within the body that isn't enhanced by sleep when you get it. And the same is true for the brain. So, for example, deep sleep that we spoke about before is the most wonderful form of blood pressure medication that you could ever hope for. Your heart rate drops, the sort of the calming branch of your nervous system kicks into high gear, stress chemicals are lowered. We also know that during dream sleep, the other state of sleep, dream sleep is a very active state, but in the brain, that's when a stress-related chemical is actually shut off. The tap closes on that sort of stress chemical so that we can start to take the difficult experiences of yesterday or the prior days. And it's almost like a nocturnal soothing balm that we just start to sort of take the sharp edge and the painful sting out of those emotional memories so that when we sort of wake up the next day, we feel better about those experiences. They don't feel as difficult or painful anymore. So there are sort of manifold benefits. You know, I almost think of sleep like the Swiss Army knife of health. You know, it's almost as though any ailment that you have, it's more than likely that sleep as a tool for the job. You know, it really is this wonderful, democratic, universally available healthcare system. And it's yours, you know, in repeat prescription form every night. You know, if you wish to pick it up, and few people do pick it up every night.
And that's the interesting thing, actually, about the kind of cultural shifts that I think there is a subliminal call for in this book, where there is a resistance, maybe, to that kind of change. I mean, I go to bed at 9:30 every night, and I know I'm countercultural. And I'm known throughout the street as the person who goes to bed very early. So there is something quite against the grain, if you like, of actually taking the level of sleep that you feel perhaps that you need. And also things around napping, how we might engage. You talked about shift work as a carcinogen. You know, how might we start thinking about embracing sleep in the ways that we work? You did a kind of beautiful description of napping and the benefits of napping in your book, where you referred to some trials undertaken with tests, and you talked about it there, about their cognition and learning capacity with nappers, you know, people who took a nap, and they got the best results. And you also refer to a study with pilots that tested what were originally called prophylactic naps, but they changed it to power naps so that pilots would actually do them.
Very American.
that were very successful in terms of ensuring that they had high performance at those crucial moments of landing. You know, how do we change a culture so that we can embed these, you know, early nights or naps that we might need in order to get the kind of requisite sleep that you're talking about?
I think sleep has an image problem right now. And the reason I say that is, if someone describes getting sufficient sleep, they tell you that they get 8 hours a night, often the response is sort of, really? And part of that actually has to do with the stigma that we apply to sleep, that you think of people who get sufficient sleep, and I choose my words very carefully, as sort of slothful, as people who don't have the same value because they sleep the right amount, the amount that it took Mother Nature 3.6 million years to put in place. How do we change that as a culture, as a society? I think it has to happen across multiple levels. The battle for sleep must begin at the individual level, but it can't end there. So, for example, when was the last time that you heard of a government public health campaign regarding sleep? You know, I don't recall one in my time here in the UK or in the US. You know, we have lots of wonderful campaigns about being active and healthy eating. We have it regarding the dangers of alcohol and tobacco. Where is sleep in that conversation? It's missing and it needs to happen. Where is sleep in healthcare? When was the last time that a doctor prescribed you a good night of sleep? And knowing what we know about sleep, I think that is justified. I think that's worthwhile. And also, I think it can come down to the level of business practice. I think we need to be more open-minded. I think we should perhaps stop lauding the airport warrior who has flown through 6 different time zones in the past 4 days, was on email until 2, and then is in the office at 6. You know, people, I don't think, should wear that badge of sleep deprivation on their arm as if it's something that is honorable. So it needs to change at government, it needs to change within healthcare, it needs to change within business. Bring it all the way down, however, into families. We know, for example, that often, as parents, we will chastise our teen children for, you know, sleeping in during the weekend, you know, pulling off the cover, saying you're wasting the day, it's daylight outside. Well, firstly, they're doing that not because they, you know, want to make you annoyed. It's a biological edict. Their 24-hour circadian rhythm is fast-forwarded in time during development. That's when they should be sleeping. But also, the reason that they are oversleeping, if you think they are, is because we have saddled them with a sleep debt during the week with this model of incessant early school start times. So it has to change within education, has to change within the home, and finally, the individual has to prioritize sleep and embrace it. Rather than stigmatize it, we should celebrate it.
It takes quite a lot of confidence, I think, to ask for what you need in terms of sleep. We had a speaker here who was an amazing academic who did request a nap before they came on because they had had an international flight and they needed to be ready for their talk. That was incredibly unusual. You know, we were very happy to host it, but it's an interesting thing that it takes some confidence to ask for it. And it was interesting. I was out with a tech entrepreneur last night who talked about the NASA nap, the 26 minutes yep. that now everyone in the tech community has the NASA nap. You know, so you wouldn't. So it's quite interesting that actually there's a sort of cultural revolution towards sleep to enable alertness because they, you know, NASA said you should, so therefore you know it's a real thing.
And I speak about that a little in the book where sort of, you know, Google and Nike actually have these nap pods and these sort of shh zones in the workplaces where you can take a nap. But in truth, it was NASA who understood this way back in the late 80s and 90s. For the astronauts, they would actually give them short nap periods. And in part, it was because of the jeopardy that would happen by way of work failures because of sleep deprivation. And what they found was that short naps would actually increase work productivity by about 34%, and it would increase overall alertness by 50%. And it became known as the NASA nap, but it was so powerful that it actually translated to the terrestrial workers too. The entire company adopted the mentality. So we are seeing a comeback. I think it's, by the way, interesting that we may have been designed to sleep in that way to begin with. Because if you actually study hunter-gatherer tribes, for example, whose way of life has not changed for thousands of years, they don't sleep the way that we sleep in modernity. They don't try and get a full 8 hours in one single bout. They sleep what we call biphasically, about sort of 7 hours at night, maybe an hour of sleep in the afternoon, the siesta-like behavior. And they're also going to bed much earlier than we do. Well, you're perfect. You said I go to bed at sort of, you know, around 9 o'clock. It's always struck me as interesting. Have you ever thought what the term midnight actually means?
Middle of the night.
Middle of the night. You know, midnight is not the time when you should think about sending the last email or checking Facebook, but that's what it's become for us. So we've dislocated ourselves both perhaps from our natural biphasic sleep pattern, but we've also, I think, shifted in our clock time sort of sleep phase as well. We're going to bed much later, I think, than we were designed to.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in the hope that we can claw back some of our leisure time from our long hours at work. There are lots of parts of this system that turn out or ultimately create the culture of a lack of sleep. Now I'm going to go to the audience. We have some microphones. So we'll start with the lady in the front and then come to go to the gentleman in the back.
Thank you for your talk. As you are talking, I was thinking, surely dreams help us to go to sleep in the most natural way, because the dream deals with the residues of the day to keep us asleep. And also, how about some emotional disciplines, like keeping a bedroom tidy, no bills, no not remember, these type of things. And how about the importance of forgetting? So they act as a way of decluttering some events so that they'll fade away. How about all this?
Three questions in one there.
Great questions. Yeah. So firstly, we know that some of the Freudian aspects of dreaming are now well falsified, and Freud was not a scientific theory. It's untestable as a theory. But it doesn't necessarily mean that Freud was actually wrong. Freud did a remarkable service to sleep science. He was the first person to actually bring dreams into the domain of the mind, which is the brain. He made sleep science and dream science part of neuroscience. Now, after that, it went wrong. He was 50% right and 100% wrong. And he was just before his time because there wasn't a neuroscience for him to build his theory on. So it was unscientific and it's not testable. But it's not to suggest that we don't deal with emotional events and experiences during the day. And I think we've already spoken about the emotional benefits of dream sleep. I think in terms of your point, which is a very good one about your bedroom, the bedroom is key for a number of reasons. Firstly, we are a dark-deprived society. darkness is actually key because as darkness ensues, it releases the brakes from a hormone called melatonin. And melatonin starts to rise within your brain and it helps time the onset of your sleep naturally. But without that cue, that trigger of darkness, melatonin gets delayed so you don't feel sleepy until much later. So the advice would be, you know, come 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night, just turn off half the lights. We don't need all of the lights blazing. Dim your screen or stop using screens. So we can help with the environment that way. Temperature is another big one in the bedroom, that you actually need to drop your core body temperature by about 1 degree Celsius to initiate sleep, which is the reason it's always easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot, because too cold is taking you in the right temperature direction. So keep your bedroom cool. I think clutter is one aspect, but I would actually say it's a side effect of the principal issue, which is the mind. And I think if there is one key component to insomnia right now, it seems to be anxiety and this Rolodex of the mind. So the advice to people, I think, would be don't go to bed still thinking about things. In this day and age, we are constantly on reception, never on reflection. And the only time when we finally reflect is when the head hits the pillow, and that is the last time when you want to start working through the day's anxieties, concerns, what didn't I do, what should I have done, what do I need to do tomorrow. At that point, you're dead in the water for the next couple of hours. So I think decluttering one's own sort of mindscape is a very good prescription for sleep. I will take some more.
A gentleman at the back was the first one, and then we'll come to the lady, and then we'll come to this side.
You're very fluent, and you throw out lots of really interesting stuff. I used to be a journalist a long time ago, and I was told off for only asking gentle questions, so I'm going to try and ask you a tough question.
If I'm wrong, I don't want to be wrong for any longer than I have to be.
You come across much more as a prophet than you do a scientist. Let me put that in context. I'm a guinea pig in a research program on dementia. And as part of that, once a year, as the reward for being in the program, we meet a lot of the dementia scientists. They're so cautious in their analysis of what causes dementia and what could ward off dementia and what could treat dementia. Now, in the talk, I'm going to buy the book because I want to see if the book has much more evidence. Yeah. In the talk, you put up a slide that seemed to show there might be a correlation between growing older and changes in sleep pattern and growing older and getting dementia. You then made a non-scientific leap, in my mind, to a statement that sleep could ward off dementia and was the best medicine going, and for cancer, and for having big testicles. If you'd made the same claim as somebody who was selling drugs as a pharmaceutical company, most of the people in this room would have been much more sceptical. But as a prophet, you're great. What reaction do you get from the rest of the scientific community on neurology? Because you're almost too good a presenter.
Well, firstly, it's very kind on the latter, but let me address the former. So, all of the work that we've published regarding the link between sleep, aging, and Alzheimer's disease has been in some of the very best journals such as Nature, for example, which have an incredibly rigorous peer review process. So the evidence is there, and I think the bottom of the slides were cut off, but all of the slides had citations to them, and I'm happy to provide those. I think 4 years ago, I would not have been so forthright regarding the link between a lack of sleep and Alzheimer's disease, but now I think the evidence is causal regarding sleep loss and Alzheimer's pathology for at least two reasons. Firstly, we know that if you take a mouse and you look at what's happening during sleep at night, this has been one of the remarkable discoveries, there is something called the glymphatic system in the brain, which essentially is your sewage system within the brain, and it kicks into high gear during deep sleep. And what we know is that one of the toxic metabolic products that deep sleep washes out of the brain is a protein called beta amyloid. And if you deprive those mice of sleep, you see an increase in beta amyloid within the brain. So there is good evidence in animal models, but what about humans? Can you make the same claim? Well, just 4 months ago, there was a paper where they took a group of healthy adults and they actually deprive them of that very same deep sleep that is normally there to wash away the toxic protein. And they did a spinal cord puncture, and they measured the cerebrospinal fluid to assess how much of that toxic protein there was in the brain. After having disrupted their sleep, that deep sleep, this is a causal manipulation, there was a significant escalation in beta amyloids as a consequence. So that's just one night. So you've got evidence in animal models, you've got evidence in humans, both of which are causal. You add that to the associational studies and the epidemiological studies that demonstrate that self-reported short duration of sleep actually increases or is correlated with increased likelihood of Alzheimer's disease. It tells a further story. I want to come on to your last point, though, because I don't want to leave that unaddressed. You said, what is the evidence that if we treat someone with sort of sleep therapy, that we could actually inflect a change for Alzheimer's? Well, that study's been done, too. They took a group of older adults who had untreated sleep apnea, that sleep-related breathing disorder where you snore and then you sort of, you gasp and you wake up. You're deprived of that deep sleep, it turns out. And they provided treatment to them. And then they tracked them. Now, some people adhered to the treatment, others didn't. Those that were successfully treated, in other words, those that had their sleep manipulated for the better, ended up staving off the onslaught of cognitive decline and ultimately Alzheimer's disease by almost 10 years relative to the untreated group. So there is another piece of causal evidence that if you inflect change by way of sleep, you can actually do something about that cognitive decline. So I know in these talks, one actually has a short amount of time to convey that evidence. And if I were to give just a talk on sleep and Alzheimer's, we would go into all of that detail, and you'll read about it in the book. But on all of those grounds, I choose my words very carefully and not flippantly. The science, I think, is quite solid behind them.
Thank you. So there was a gentleman here and then gentleman here. And then we'll come to the lady in the front, and I think we might need to wrap up with that.
Thank you. You talk about sufficient sleep, and I take it for granted there is some sort of a distribution curve for individuals, you know, around some mean in the middle. So how does an individual determine what is sufficient for them?
So certainly I think sleep need differs from one individual to the next, and that's critically important to recognize. Somewhere between 7 to 9 hours of sleep seems to be the sweet spot for most humans. What we know is that once you get below 7, you tend to be able to measure objective impairment in human beings. What is the right amount for you? Well, I would firstly say, I guess the other question is, how do you know that you're getting enough sleep is another way to ask it. If you would sleep past your alarm clock, should it not go off, it presumably means that you're not getting enough sleep. That's one way of knowing it. The other is, are you self-medicating yourself with caffeine early in the morning? Because that should normally be your peak alertness. And it's always struck me sometimes when I will get on a plane, let's say it's a sort of a 10 o'clock flight, and there used to be a time when we were taking off where you couldn't do anything, you just had to sit in your seat, no gadgets, no nothing. And I'd look around me, and almost half of the plane was fast asleep, 10:30 in the morning. That should be biologically impossible at that stage, if you are getting sufficient sleep. So I think you can just listen to yourself and sort of know where that sweet spot sits for you. Also, you know, if you were to go on a camping trip and there was no electronics, no light, do you think it's likely that you would be going to bed earlier than you would otherwise? And if that's true, then you're probably giving way to your natural biological tendency that modernity is actually pushed back or pushed forward in terms of time. But that would be the key measure. Do you wake up? Do you feel refreshed and restored? That's one key measure. But the reason I think that that's potentially dangerous is that insufficient sleep ends up resetting your baseline. So you end up thinking this is what life is like with insufficient sleep. And we know this from people who, again, have untreated sleep disorders. And when you treat them, you know, they'll often tell you, I had an amazing person in a clinic 2 years ago who was treated for sleep apnea. And he said, it was almost as though, you know, I'd wiped a foggy window clean. And finally, I could see clearly for the same time. Now, he wasn't talking about his vision. He just meant in terms of his physical wellness. So I think that's the danger in saying, do I feel alert and restored every day? That's not a bad measure. I would say if you're sleeping past your alarm, or you could sleep past your alarm should it not go off, then you probably need more sleep.
So we'll go to the lady here and then we'll finish with you.
Oh, hello. I've been doing some research on singing and well-being. And after running a singing for group session, people feel energised. So my question is really, what if instead of having a nap, someone was to sing for 26 minutes or do some sport or something else that made them feel physically energised? Would this have the same effect on your health clock as a nap, or are you just becoming an adrenaline junkie?
Well, it's not going to be the same as a nap, because those two things are almost polar opposite on the physiological scale, sort of alertness and, you know, high activity versus quiescence and sleep. What I would say, though, however, is that exercise is actually, or being physically active, actually has an interesting benefit for sleep. That if you are physically active, as long as it's not too close to bed, it can increase the depth of your sleep and improve what we call the consolidated nature of sleep, that you sleep contiguously rather than having multiple awakenings. And that evidence, I think, is somewhat strong, but it's perhaps not as strong as we expected it to be. But when scientists turned the analytical tables, we were presented with a surprise. It's even more powerful in the opposite direction, which is that sleep at night and the better sleep that you have at night means that, firstly, you are far more motivated to be physically active the following day. When you are physically active, you exert far more physical energy and power when working out. And so there is a sort of a golden cycle or loop between these two, between sleep and exercise. Does exercise during the day help you sleep better? Yes, it does for many people. If you're incredibly physically active, perhaps that ultimate benefit doesn't sustain over the, it's not just linear and goes, you know, beyond, it plateaus. But if anything, the opposite direction is true. So it's a two-way street, but perhaps the flow of traffic is even more dominant in terms of sleep gifting you physical vigor and vitality. Yeah.
And our last question.
Thank you, first of all. I'm really interested in your study on direct current brain stimulation. Is there a Pavlovian effect? So if you continue to apply the brain stimulation to increase the, what did you call those, the top end of the...
brainwaves and the sleep spindles.
The sleep spindles. Yeah. Would your brain eventually remember how to do that? Would it hardwire it? So if we were to apply that technique in adolescence, it would remain with the person throughout their life. So is it a longitudinal study that you're doing?
So at present, it's not a longitudinal study. And the answer is we actually don't yet know how long the impact of that stimulation is. For example, if you were to give, you know, two doses, you know, night one and night two, do you see some carryover, some sort of continued echo effect on subsequent nights? And at what point does that dissipate? And when do you need the next dose, as it were, to maintain efficacy? My suspicion is that it doesn't have a long tail that lasts more than probably perhaps days. I would be surprised, but, you know, as a scientist, who knows? Open-minded, we will see. I think I would probably be a little concerned about applying it too early in life. I think that the brain is undergoing, you know, such dramatic neural architecture and manipulation that we should sort of let it mature. I think the circumstances where I would feel comfortable with that technology are circumstances where sleep is starting to fail. Aging, Alzheimer's disease being good examples. I think psychiatric disorders, I think there is good cause to think about treatment there too. So how longitudinally efficacious that actually is, unclear. It would be lovely to think that you could sort of offer a couple of doses, almost like a child on a swing, that you sort of get them going, and then after a while you can sort of just stop and it self-perpetuates. My guess is that it will need repeat administration.
I'm really sorry, we've slightly gone over time, and I know there are more questions in the audience, but I don't want to keep you from getting back to the things that you need to do. So it just remains for me to say thank you so much for such an interesting and illuminating conversation, and bringing it out of the kind of wake-up call of you need some sleep and into some of the depth of how to do that. So please join me in giving a big hand to our guest speaker, Matthew Walker.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.